program titled Protecting Confidential Information and Client Relationships in the Financial Services Industry. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Seifarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general informational purposes only. You are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purposes of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation. That will be required on a CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn the program over to Scott Humphrey. You may begin.
Good morning or afternoon, everyone, depending on where you are today. Like she said, my name is Scott Humphrey, and I'm here along with Marcus Mentz and Christine Argentine. We are lawyers in Chicago for Seifarth Shaw. All three of us specialize in the enforcement and protection of trade secrets and confidential information, and we look forward to speaking with you today about protecting confidential information and client relationships in the trade in the financial services industry. What we'll cover today will be a high-level view of what are trade secrets, the practical steps that financial services can implement to protect trade secrets and client relationships, what to do if a FINRA member takes your trade secrets or violates their agreements, and lastly, the latest in FINRA rules, of which one came about just a week ago, as well as the impact that the protocol for broker recruiting has in these types of cases and with respect to the protection of your trade secrets and confidential information. So with that, I'll turn it over to Christine Argentine.
Thanks, Scott. As Scott mentioned, we're going to start with kind of an overview of what trade secrets are and what does that mean for you. What information do you have that can be protected under the various acts? So first, we'll start by saying that a trade secret is one of the most elusive and difficult concepts in the law to define. So a lot of courts have analyzed this and have talked about what that means and what is protectable, and basically it comes down to a case-by-case basis usually and what it is you're trying to protect and what is involved in that information. So the Uniform Trade Secrets Act is the primary law governing this topic, and what that provides is a uniform definition of trade secret as well as what misappropriation is with respect to those trade secrets. The Uniform Trade Secrets Act is followed by 48 states. Massachusetts and New York are the exception there. They do not follow the Uniform Trade Secrets Act or have not adopted it. They follow common law, but overall, the standards for what a trade secret is in all states are fairly similar. In addition, there's going to be a Federal Trade Secrets Act, we believe, that's going to be adopted, and Marcus is going to talk more about that later on. So here's the formal definition under the Uniform Trade Secrets Act of what a trade secret is. Basically, courts have stated, and the Fifth Circuit in particular has stated, that in general, a trade secret is information used in one's business and which gives an opportunity to obtain an advantage over competitors who do not know or use it. So what does that mean? Basically, you need to meet two specific criteria. You need to have something or information that is a trade secret, or that is a secret, meaning it's not generally known in the industry, can't be reverse engineered by a competitor without, you know, a lot of effort. So in general, courts will look to a number of factors when deciding whether or not something is a secret. And some of those factors include the extent to which that information is known outside of the business, the extent to which it's known by employees and under other individuals within the business. Courts look at the amount of effort or money expended in developing the information or the amount of time it takes to develop that information. And then they also look at the ease or difficulty with which the information can be properly acquired or duplicated by others. And then the second prong of that is this information kept secret by the owner of it? So does the company or person that has the trade secret take actual steps to protect that information? And those steps can include things like confidentiality agreements or password-protected computers. Marcus is going to get into that more later in this presentation on what a company can do to protect its information that they deem trade secret. So here's some examples of different types of materials that may be considered a trade secret depending on the content of those materials or the data that you're keeping or collecting. Customer lists are always a big topic in litigation. A lot of times the courts will look at whether or not the type of information that's kept with that customer list. So are you keeping customer preferences with that list? Are you keeping specific order histories, specific procedures? Essentially, are you keeping things with your customer list that are not available to the general public, that someone couldn't just go to a phone book and look up, you know, all the people that sell a certain product or are interested in a certain product? Also, internal documents that have been developed by your company, internal analyses, all that type of information that you don't want your competitors to have is potentially a trade secret that you would be able to protect under the Uniform Trade Secret Act or other laws. So what information might not be a trade secret? That's going to be information that is publicly available or can be compiled through public information. Information that your company might put on your blog that you put out to the public is not going to be able to be protected as a trade secret. Similarly, off-the-shelf software or programs are not going to be protected. In a recent Northern District of Illinois decision, the court found that a company's ordering of forms and templates specific to their company, even though they had were designed by the company, they came from a commercial vendor, which meant that they couldn't be protected as a trade secret. You also want to keep in mind that companies have to be careful about continuing to maintain the secrecy of their information. So, you know, even if they mark the information confidential or protect it on your computers through passwords or through confidentiality agreements, once you give that information away to someone and that person doesn't have an obligation to keep it confidential, you may waive your rights to protect it as a trade secret. So there's some recent cases across the country that will illustrate how these cases are being decided and how trade secrets are being protected. In this Lake Treasure Holdings case, this is an example of the trade secrets not being protected, even though the company took steps to protect the information. They believed that they had developed unique algorithms, but in the end, an expert determined that all of the components of their algorithms were readily available and could be recreated, and so the trade secrets claim was in that case denied. Here are some recent decisions outlining cases that where the trade secrets were upheld and the company was allowed protection of their trade secrets under the Act. So in the Stevens case, the court in particular found it wasn't necessary for the contact information or the customer information that was in these lists to be necessarily a secret, but the fact that those customers were individuals that desired financial services, that's something that made that customer list in particular a trade secret to the company. In the CDM Media USA case, that's a case where they were trying to protect a membership list for a LinkedIn group. And again, there, the company was able to protect their list because it was a list of specific people interested in speaking engagements, and that list of people had been collected over time by the company and taken a lot of effort for the company to develop, so that was protected as a trade secret. And then in the last case, this Square Inc. case, that's a case related to the technology for credit card swipes that go on the top of a phone. And in that case, the technology was reviewed and described in various blogs on the internet and other websites. And so the court found that that didn't make that information generally available. They still protected that information because the websites were rather obscure and they weren't necessarily out in the general public or something that a competitor wouldn't know to look at to gain this information. So I'm going to turn it over now to Marcus, and he's going to talk about the best ways for companies to protect their trade secrets and legal options for those companies in case those trade secrets are misappropriated.
All right. Thanks, Christine. So the first thing here is we're going to assume that we have a trade secret, that the company has information that satisfies all the requirements that Christine walked through. So the next most important thing is that the company must make sure that the trade secret that they developed remains an actual trade secret. And this is important for a couple reasons. The first is that if a trade secret is not kept confidential and kept secret, if it's not protected, it may not legally be considered a trade secret anymore. But perhaps most important is that if the information is not protected, it may very well get disclosed, and then the company will lose all value that it had developed any value that the information had as a trade secret will no longer exist. So what level of security is required? What must a company do to make sure that information that is a trade secret is sufficiently protected? And the key here is reasonableness under the circumstances. So the more valuable the information, the greater steps that a court is going to expect a company is going to take in order to preserve trade secret status. So in other words, if a company has the secret sauce, the secret recipe on which its entire continued viability relies upon, the court is going to expect that that company is going to take a much higher level of effort in order to keep that information confidential. You know, on the other hand, if there's information that is of a more mundane variety that is more widely disseminated in the company, then the efforts to keep that information confidential are not going to be as extreme as that of the secret recipe, secret sauce example. So what are best practices to protect trade secret information? And we've identified audit, create culture, and enforce. Starting with audit, the first thing that we recommend doing is auditing the company's trade secret practices. What does the company do to protect its confidential information? And again, going back to reasonableness under the circumstances, the focus here is what is the company doing in light of the information it is attempting to preserve? And is that sufficient? The second is the culture of the company in terms of confidentiality. Employees must understand and buy into the fact that the information they have access to is valuable to the company, it's valuable for the ongoing viability of the company, and everyone is responsible for keeping that information confidential that has access to it. Finally, enforcement, and here consistency is key. The company must be consistent in its efforts to protect information, and if threatened disclosure or disclosure ever occurs, the company must promptly and consistently take all necessary steps to prevent disclosure of its information. So this means that if an employee leaves and information is taken with, every time the company must take reasonable actions to recover its information and make sure that disclosure and misuse does not occur. So what are some specific things about creating a culture of confidentiality? The first thing is that The company must specifically identify in writing what information is considered confidential. And this is to every employee who will have access to that information. So this can be done at the outset in an employment agreement, in handbooks, or a specific confidentiality agreement. We've marked it in bold, mark things confidential, and we can't stress this enough. This is important because there can be no claim of confusion or I didn't know information is confidential when we have bold lettering saying this information that you're holding in your hands or you're looking at on a computer screen is confidential. And this is important for another reason, too. If information is ever misappropriated and disclosed, anyone that's receiving this information sees confidential property of company. That person is going to be on notice that they have no right to have this information and that it's confidential information. It's confidential property of the company. And again, consistency is key. Uniform security protocols, uniform enforcement. You know, where this can come up is that if in one department the company is excellent in employees and confidentiality agreements, it marks all documents confidential, but then we have another segment of the company where those steps aren't taken and information is disclosed or leaked. That can jeopardize the status of information as a trade secret and can result in disclosure of that information. So next we're going to review some measures that can be taken to protect trade secret information. As we mentioned before, agreements with employees is a great starting place. This would be every employee that's going to have access to our confidential information should have an employment agreement or non-disclosure agreement, some type of document where they acknowledge what information they're going to have access to, acknowledge that that information is considered confidential, and their agreement that they will not use, misuse, disclose, or otherwise misappropriate our confidential information. This can also be supported with an employee policy and handbook. And again, if we're going to protect our information with our employees, it's important that we do so with anyone else that may have access to our information. This could be with vendors, contractors, anyone that we might be entering into a business arrangement with. Essentially, anyone that's going to have access to our information, we should have a confidentiality agreement with them. Next is secure networking facility. So in the first instance, we're talking about electronic data, which is by far the most prevalent. And what are some things we can do? Well, creating logons and passwords and specific authentication for anyone to have access to the computer networks, and then segmenting within our network system who has access to specific information. So this means that not everyone has access to all information. Only the people that specifically need access to trade secret information will actually have access to that specific information. Lock and key. If we have hard copy documents that are confidential, keep them under lock and key so not anyone can access them. In some circumstances where we have particularly sensitive or confidential information, we can restrict the ability to print, download, or even externally email that information out. Again, notices. We had it in bold earlier. Mark documents confidential for internal use only. Just make sure that anyone that sees it, uses it, has access to that information, you know, clearly understands that the information is considered confidential by the company. So also the protocol for broker recruiting is specific to companies in the financial industry. And Scott's going to talk about that a little bit later on. What to do in case of theft, loss, or breach. So we've taken all necessary steps to protect our information, but nonetheless, an employee is able to obtain that information, perhaps when they're departing and they go to a competitor. What should we do? The first thing is to investigate whether what information was taken, how it was taken, what the scope of the information is, particularly with electronic data, forensic analysis of the computers and the electronic devices the employee had access to is the first step. Next, in certain circumstances, a cease and desist letter saying, return all our information, account for anything you had access to, may be sufficient. In many circumstances, the next step will be court intervention. And this almost always takes the form of seeking a temporary restraining order, where essentially we're petitioning the court to, in an emergency manner, immediately after the employee leaves, to say, account for all information the employee may have taken and account for anyone that they disclose the information to immediately return that information and to cease any additional disclosure. In certain circumstances, if it's client data, we may be under a state or federal obligation to notify the client that their information may have been compromised. To the extent insurance is implicated, we should notify our insurers. And finally, what can we learn from the breach, and is there any steps that we could have taken to make sure that a breach doesn't happen again in that same manner? This can involve, different policies, different agreements, maybe additional training with our employees. All stakeholders should be involved, from leadership to IT, particularly with the electronic data, as well as operations personnel. So if preventable, the goal here is let's make sure it can't happen again. So what specific legal options are available? Well, the first thing is that if we have a confidentiality agreement, we can pursue claims for breach of that agreement and enforce certain provisions that we might include. So there's a number of federal statutes that allow for private rights of action in the case of misappropriation. So as Christine mentioned earlier, the Federal Defend Trade Secrets Act is going to be put before the president for signature, and then that will become effective. Again, as we mentioned earlier, temporary restraining orders and injunctive relief are almost always the first thing that companies will seek to do. Emergency relief to get a TRO, it's key that companies act promptly to go before the court and to stop any harm from happening before it does. If information is disclosed or misused, money damages might be available. Money damages can take the form of lost profits, disgorgement of salary or benefits from the bad actor, as well as calculating damages to goodwill or the value of trade secrets, or even reasonable royalties that would be a measure of damages based on the value that the company received or the value that the misuser may have been obtaining. And in certain circumstances, attorney's fees and exemplary damages may be available in the case of a willful misappropriation of trade secrets. So, as we talked about before, the Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2016 is a big deal. For the first time, assuming the president signs the legislation into law, there will be a private federal cause of action for misappropriation of trade secrets. This means that instead of having state court, regardless of diversity jurisdiction, courts can seek relief in federal court for misappropriation. The Defend Trade Secret Act is closely modeled after the Uniform Trade Secret Act. As Christine mentioned, that's the law in virtually every state. And so based on that modeling, we expect that courts are going to borrow heavily on the Uniform Trade Secret Act in cases interpreting that act to apply the Defend Trade Secret Act. One important distinction to point out is that in order to obtain attorney's fees or exemplary damages in the case of willful misappropriation, employers under the Defend Trade Secret Act must include safe harbor language in the agreements that any disclosure of trade secret information for the purpose of reporting a violation under law is necessary. We have detailed analysis available going through the provisions of the Act, and if you'd like to learn more, you can reach out to any one of us or visit the Saifar Shah Trading Secrets blog. So, and last, before I pass over to Scott, the most important thing, the CLE code. So, to receive one credit of CLE for this webinar, please write down the following code on the CLE attendance affirmation form, which will be emailed to you early next week. The code is SS, as in Saifar Shah, 3377.
Thank you, Marcus. So the next question, the last question for today is, well, okay, what happens if you're a FINRA member, which we suspect all of you are, if not nearly all of you are, because if you're not a FINRA member, then your enforcement mechanisms are very simple and traditionally have been, if you have diversity, you file in federal court. If you don't have diversity, you file in state court to enjoin someone from using your confidential information or to enforce your restrictive covenants. However, as Marcus mentioned just a few seconds ago, the Defend Trade Secrets Act now creates federal court jurisdiction. So even if you the company and the former agent, broker, dealer are from the same state, you can now still get into federal court, again, once President Obama signs the act, which we suspect he will in the next 10 days, you can now go in federal court and you don't have to worry about diversity. So that's important. But what's also important, and perhaps even more important for a FINRA member, is understanding that FINRA has its own set of rules that must be complied with, and they all start with Rule 13804. Rule 13804 allows a FINRA member to seek court involvement in the enforcement of its restrictive covenant agreements, as well as with respect to enforcement and protection of its confidential information, but only for a limited time. And what I mean by that is, if you read Rule 13804, what it says is, you can, as a FINRA member, file in federal court, or state court, but now most likely federal court, given the new act, so long as, and only so long as, you also file with FINRA at the same time. So in other words, whereas a non-FINRA member only has one pleading, one complaint in federal court, you as FINRA members need to have two pleadings, one in federal court and one in FINRA. What the FINRA rule further goes on to state is you can seek temporary relief, temporary injunctive relief, but if you get your temporary injunctive relief, you then have to notify FINRA, and FINRA will convene a panel within 15 days to decide what to do about the court's ruling. And what the FINRA panel can do after that's 15 days is it can agree to follow the court ruling, the TRO order. It can decide to modify that TRO order. And what I mean by that is, let's say, for example, that you have a order from the court that says this person will not be allowed to use any of your confidential information, including customer lists and marketing materials, the FINRA panel can say, well, we're going to keep that order in place with respect to the customer list, but those marketing materials, they're fair game. They don't really contain that much confidential information. So if they want to copy those materials and just switch out the name of the old firm with the name of the new firm, that's going to be okay. The other thing that should be pointed out here is, once the FINRA panel makes its ruling, then everything from that step or that point forward goes through FINRA. So in other words, the court case dies, and you are then left with FINRA as the judge, jury, and executioner for the rest of the way. What that also means, and where you will see some disagreement in the court system, is over the FINRA language 13804 as to what exactly constitutes a temporary injunctive relief. Most courts will say that temporary injunctive relief means temporary restraining order. There is, though, a sliver of case law out there that allows a party to make the argument that temporary injunctive relief means preliminary injunction. And the reason why that's important, and that's a distinguishment that you need to understand regardless of whether you're on the plaintiff's side or the defendant's side, or in the case of FINRA, the claimant's side or the respondent's side, is for a temporary restraining order, you typically just have affidavits. It can be ex parte. There's no real substantive, invasive, lengthy discovery. But for a preliminary injunction hearing, you can have depositions occur before then, and preliminary injunction hearings typically have live witnesses. And that's important because FINRA, you're not allowed to have live witnesses before the arbitration hearing. You're not allowed to conduct depositions period. The only time that FINRA ever allows a deposition to take place is if you can show that that person's unavailable for the FINRA arbitration hearing and their testimony is necessary in order for the panel to make its ruling. So if you are the plaintiff, you need to make the tactical decision of, do you want to push the court for a preliminary injunction hearing as opposed to a TRO because you want to take the shot at getting some discovery that you wouldn't get otherwise. Similarly, if you're on the defense side, you want to make the decision of, okay, if they filed a TRO, do I want to contest that TRO and then go to FINRA? And if they go and are not successful, but they want to then move for the preliminary injunction hearing, do I want to contest that not only before the court, but also within FINRA and tell FINRA, listen, they had their shot at the TRO, they now want to get a preliminary injunctive relief, or they've decided to bypass their shot at a TRO and are moving for a preliminary injunctive relief. FINRA, that's not what Rule 13804 allows. You need to take control of this litigation now. You need to take it over from the court system. So those are things to think about depending on which side you're on in a dispute between FINRA members involving confidential information as well as restrictive covenants. The other thing that you'll see here that we talk about is respect to Rule 11870 and Rule 2140. What those rules cover is the ability of an individual to do business with a broker dealer that they want to do business with. And what those rules stand for is that you cannot prevent accounts from transferring. So if an individual on his own decides that he wants to go with his former broker to their new firm, the rules state that you cannot block any of that paperwork and you have to allow that account to be transferred. Now, what some people have said at both the court system as well as in FINRA proceedings is that those two rules basically negate any non-solicitation language in any restrictive covenant agreement, any type of employment agreement, confidentiality agreement, what have you. And if you come across that rule, or you come across someone making that argument, it's important to note that in the exhibits to Rule 2140, the rules, the notices, there is a specific language from 2012 where FINRA and the SEC stated that this rule is not meant to prohibit the enforcement of any restrictive covenant agreement. So again, if you have somebody who's making these arguments about Rule 11870 and 2140, basically negating, voiding non-solicit agreements, you should have those rules and those notices in your back pocket. The last one, and this is what I mentioned at the very beginning of this webinar, is Rule 2273, which hasn't been enacted yet, but by way of background for those of you who aren't familiar with it, Rule 2273 talks about certain information, and it's been dubbed the electronic communication information by FINRA, that members now need to give to individuals before they are permitted to transmit their accounts. And Rule 2273 has been kicked around, has been incubating, I should say, for roughly 3 years. It started as a drive to disclose broker compensation. However, the industry pushed back and pushed back rather strongly on that decision or that inkling from FINRA. And so what happened was Rule 2273 then got changed or modified and morphed into a language that basically says that if you are going to contact your customers, you need to tell them of any conflicts that they might have if they decide to send their business with you to the new brokerage house, any costs that they will incur as a result of transferring their accounts from your former brokerage house to the new brokerage house, as well as any product differences between the former brokerage house and the new brokerage house, the former financial institution and the new financial institution. And it's that product difference language in the electronic communication that we'll be watching closely over the next couple of years, because a crafty attorney can say, well, hey, listen, under that communication, FINRA is allowing me to talk about the differences. That's necessarily a solicitation, because I'm explaining to them why my products at my new institution is better than my products at my old institution, and therefore, you can't accuse me of violating any type of non-solicitation agreement. Again, that's in the infancy stages. Rule 2273 hasn't been enforced yet, or I shouldn't say FINRA hasn't implemented it. We've spoken to a couple people, including one individual at FINRA, who tells us that most likely the rule will go into effect in October or later of this year, because they want to give firms time to build up the necessary infrastructure to comply with it. But again, that's something that we'll be watching, and you should check our blog periodically, especially around October, as we'll continue to watch Rule 2273 and its potential impact on FINRA broker members. The other key differences that we should point out, and this is very important, because again, you will be giving up certain avenues or aspects of discovery that you wouldn't have if you were in court. Like we talked about before, full discovery, you know, court interrogatories, depositions, requests to admit, you know, expert depositions, individual depositions, third-party depositions. You don't get that in FINRA. In FINRA, you don't get interrogatories. You get basically equivalent of document requests. You know, you don't get any further relief after the panel convenes 15 days and decides what they're going to do with that temporary restraining order. Rules of evidence, they're out the window in FINRA. If you you know, talk to people who do FINRA arbitrations, a lot of them will refer to them as the Wild Wild West, and I agree with that. And a lot of the reason why is because the arbitration panel may or may not consist of lawyers. Now, I will say FINRA has gotten better over the last 18 months with respect to these cases and making sure that they give you a list of potential panelees that have at least a little bit of knowledge or a little bit of involvement of these types of cases. But still, a lot of times you're going to get at least one, maybe two industry members who are not lawyers, are lawyers who are not familiar with these types of proceedings. That's much different than a judge, you know, who has not only himself or herself, but his clerks to go back, review case law, read cases, understand them, and issue a reasoned legal opinion. That's not what you get at the end of a FINRA arbitration proceeding. Also, you know, damages. Experts will tell you, hey, you know, this value or this book of business was worth X because of a variety of factors. And FINRA proceedings, you usually just look at the trailing 12s. What was the revenue that was generated over the last 12 months? Okay, that's what we're going to start with. And usually you work downward from those trailing 12s. Occasionally you can get a panel to work upwards of the trailing 12s, but that's unusual. We talked about arbitrator justice, and I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way, but arbitrations, they don't have to follow the law. They don't have to follow jury instructions. They get to decide what they believe is fair and just, and therefore you're taking a risk because you're deciding on three individuals what they feel is right as opposed to a judge that has to follow the law. So with all that being said, the one additional layer for those of you that are involved with it are that those of you that are hiring people that are involved with it is the protocol for broker recruiting. And for those of you that aren't familiar with it, it was an agreement that got executed in 2004 by really three main players, Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and UBS. And what they decided was that they wanted to try to limit, if not eliminate, the litigation, FINRA or court between individuals and institutions that occurred when brokers left one institution and went to another. Since they started the protocol in 2004, it's gained momentum, you know, especially during the financial crisis, and now is over 1,200 signatures. It was initially administered by FINRA and then SIFMA, but last year, SIFMA decided to have an outside law firm handle it. and to monitor it so that, you know, if anybody's looking to see if so-and-so is a FINRA member, or sorry, a member of the Protocol for Broker Recruiting, it is, you go to the website, you look, yeah, it's broken down alphabetically, and you look for the name, and that's basically how you find out who the members are. And at its core, like I mentioned before, it allows for reciprocal poaching. It allows individuals to take certain information with them when they leave their former financial institution. And specifically, and perhaps the most important of it, it allows you to take client names, addresses, telephone numbers, email addresses, and account titles. And why that's important is if you go and you look at your agreements, and specifically the confidential information definition of your agreements, they usually say the following information is confidential: client names, addresses, telephone numbers, email addresses, and account information. So if you're a member or you're considering being a member of the protocol, you need to go back and look at your agreements, employment agreements, confidentiality agreements, NDAs, what have you, to see if joining the protocol will negate or void some of your confidential information restrictions. Because the protocol is clear, and the courts have enforced this when this issue is raised, that if you join the protocol, that trumps any language that you have in your confidential definition. Or you can put differently, you can't claim that any of that information is confidential if you join the protocol and say that that information can be taken by someone when they leave you to go to another firm. Naturally, then, the protocol also bars you from seeking any damages or injunctive relief if that person goes to another firm, with one exception, and that is if you can show that the person did not act in good faith in complying with the protocol. And what that means by that is they didn't leave the list of information that they took with them. They maybe downloaded some information after they left. Basically, you have to show that they did not act in good faith when they left. Otherwise, there's nothing you can do. It also bars individuals, or I should say, I apologize, let me back up. There is one other exception to that as well, and that is if the individual is a member of a team. So in other words, if Christine, Marcus, and I are part of a team that is servicing a number of customers, and Marcus decides to leave to go to a competitor, the protocol does not allow him to take confidential customer information mentioned in these three bullet points with him if he has an agreement in place that bars him from doing so. So in other words, if Marcus signed an agreement with the company that says, I agree to not take this information with me, I agree to not use this information for any benefit other than for on behalf of the institution, he's still bound by that because he was working on a client team. The fact that we are a signatory to the protocol doesn't matter. He is, however, allowed to take the customer information with him for clients that he solely serviced by himself. So if Marcus had a separate list of, say, 30 clients that he serviced on his own, he can take that, but he can't take the client information for the 100 clients that Marcus, Christine, and I serviced for the institution. So we've talked about the FINRA and the protocol impact, and it's important to notice that the three distinguishing issues where this gets raised. One is, what happens when there's litigation, either in FINRA and the courts, between two signatories to the protocol? Then what's the situation where the plaintiff is a signatory to the protocol, but the defendant is not? And then what about when the plaintiff is not a signatory to the protocol and the defendant is? Well, the first part, where both plaintiff and defendant are part of the protocol, that's easy. The courts say, you have this agreement, you got to honor that agreement, so therefore, unless we can show that the departing broker or brokers failed to comply with the requirements of the protocol or did not act in good faith in trying to comply with the protocol, protocol applies, you cannot get damages, you cannot get injunctive relief, everybody please go their separate ways. With respect to a situation where the plaintiff is a signatory and the defendant is not, the courts have held that the plaintiff, by signing the protocol, has basically said that you can take that information with you out the door. And so the non-signatory defendant or the non-signatory defendant's firm can hold the signatory, the protocol's restrictions against the plaintiff. And what I mean by that is the defendant can say, hey, listen, I'm not part of the protocol, but you are, and you said that this information is not confidential because you said anybody who walks out the door can take this information with them if they comply with these steps. And so it's important to know, if you're a protocol firm, that those requirements are going to be held against you even if your brokers go to a non-protocol firm. The last one is a situation where the plaintiff is not a member of the protocol and the defendant is. And so far, the cases have consistently held that the protocol does not apply in those situations. What's interesting is in those cases is that the defendant has tried to make the argument, and at least one of them, where they said, hey, listen, this protocol, this is industry standard. Look at all these 1,200 signatories to it. So, you know, court, you should just acknowledge that this is the industry standard and therefore apply it. And courts have routinely rejected that argument. Now, it's also been made in some arbitration proceedings as well, but as everybody knows here, those proceedings are not open to the public. So, to the best of our knowledge, that's never carried the day in any arbitration proceeding. There's no arbitration published opinion that carries that day. But nevertheless, you should be aware that from time to time, you will get somebody arguing, hey, this is the industry standard. That has been traditionally rejected, largely because although there are 1,200 institutions that have signed on to the signatory to the protocol, there is also significant large non-protocol members, large financial institutions that have outright rejected it, refused to abide by it, as well as a large number of smaller shops that have also chosen not to follow it. So again, what this means from an impact on your agreements is, for those of you that have already signed on to it, you need to check to see, does this mean that certain language in your agreements are no longer valid and enforceable? It also means not only with respect to confidential information, but also with restrictive covenants, non-competes, non-solicits, non-hire provisions. Has signing on to the protocol made those provisions as unenforceable as well? And for those of you that are thinking about joining the protocol or weighing whether or not to join the protocol, these are the things you got to consider. And that is, hey, listen, if we go down this path and we decide to become a protocol member, do we need to change our agreements? And are we willing to give up these types of restrictions and these types of protections in order to become part of the protocol? That also comes into play with respect to mergers and acquisitions. There's a real interesting story back during the financial crisis, when a lot of consolidation was occurring for a lot of reasons that all of us know about, where some of the consolidation was between a protocol firm and a non-protocol firm. And the acquiring company was actually a non-protocol firm, but they agreed to sign on to the protocol because they wanted those individuals to come over, keep their books of business with the firm. However, if you read the stories and the articles about it, it seems that the non-protocol member firm wasn't aware of all of this at the time, and then when some of these people left, tried to file suit and against them and were not successful because they had signed off on the protocol. So that's why, if you're looking at a merger, if you're looking at an acquisition, it's important to ask if they're a protocol firm. And if so, is that something that you want to adopt or acquire by acquiring this firm? And then, you know, what has probably been a theme that you guys have picked up on during the roughly 45 minutes that Christine Marcus and I have been talking is, it's important to address these issues before the crisis. It's important to address, are you adequately protecting your trade secrets before they actually walk out the door? It's important to address whether the new Defend Trade Secrets Act impacts your agreement, impacts where you can bring a lawsuit before you have to actually make that decision. It's important to know and address the protocol's impact on you or on the hiring that you want to do, large scale or small scale, before people start walking out the door, start raising it as a defense, start using it as a shield or a sword against you. It's the old Ben Franklin adage, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and that definitely applies to these types of cases, to these types of issues. So with that, we're going to take a brief pause, look at and review the questions that you have submitted to us, and then we'll be back to answer your questions. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will conduct the question and answer session. To ask a question via the web presentation, select the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. We are now ready to begin. Our speakers are composing the questions at this time. Just give us a few minutes.
And thank you very much for the questions. The first question is, have we seen any set, you know, standards or typical things that financial services institutions do in order to protect their confidential information? And for that, I'll turn that over to Christine Argentine.
Thanks, Scott. Yeah, I mean, definitely you have to assess what's best for your business, but some of the things that we typically see are, you know, password protecting your computers and monitoring who has access to certain confidential information, different types of agreements. We also, you know, recommend, and Marcus talked about this a little bit earlier, doing an audit to see what your procedures are, see that they're in place, make sure that your different departments are following them, and then also do periodic follow-ups to make sure that everything is still being run the way you expect it to be run, looking at how laws have changed, how the industries have changed, and seeing if you need to make any updates to the protocols that you had previously put in place.
Thank you, Christine. And then another question is, do we believe that the Defend Trade Secrets Act will cause a seismic shift in trade secret and non-compete cases? And for that, I'll turn it over to Marcus Mintz.
Well, that's a good question. What we think about the Defend Trade Secret Act is that it is not going to change the substantive law. It's most likely going to mirror the existing case law that we've seen throughout the country in all the states that have adopted the Uniform Trade Secret Act. We expect that the courts applying the Defend Trade Secret Act will rule substantially similar to what is a trade secret, has there been misappropriation, and so on. But where we see a big shift is going to be in venue. Prior to the enactment, or what we anticipate will be what will become law, venue for citizens of the same state is going to be in state court unless there was some other basis for federal jurisdiction. Once the Defend Trade Secret Act becomes law, we expect that many of the cases that are now being litigated in state court will be in federal courts. This can create a lot more reported decisions and a lot more, a much wider body of reported law. And so those will be the two things. We'll see a lot more reported federal decisions discussing trade secrets. And now we're going to expect to see a lot more cases being filed in federal court.
And thank you. Thanks, Marcus. And thank you for the other questions. Unfortunately, we are out of time. So we will get back to you individually. Also, our contact information is now on the screen. Please feel free to reach out to Christine, Marcus, or me with any questions you have. You can email us or give us a call. The general number is 312-460-5000. My number is 312-460-5528. Marcus's is
312-460-5585.
And Christine says?
312-460-5332.
Okay, great. And also don't hesitate or be afraid to go and visit our blog, tradesecretslaw.com, for the most up-to-date information on these types of cases. Lastly, we have another webinar on May 10th titled Trade Secrets, Restrictive Covenants, and the NLRB. Can they peacefully coexist? Once again, that will be on May 10th. So thank you, everyone, for your time, and have a great weekend.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending. You may now disconnect.